This is Audible.
From the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Jack Sondericker, reading This Present Darkness by Frank E. Peretti. Chapter 1. Late on a full moon Sunday night, the two figures in work clothes appeared on Highway 27, just outside the small college town of Ashton. They were tall, at least 7 feet, strongly built, perfectly proportioned. One was dark-haired and sharp-featured, the other blonde and powerful. From a half a mile away, they looked toward the town, regarding the cacophonic sounds of gaiety from the storefronts, streets, and alleys within it. They started walking. It was the time of the Ashton Summer Festival, the town's yearly exercise in frivolity and chaos. Its way of saying thank you, come again, good luck, and nice to have you to the 800 or so college students at Whitmore College, who would be getting their long-awaited summer break from classes. Most would pack up and go home, but all would definitely stay at least long enough to take in the festivities, the street disco, the carnival rides, the nickel movies, and whatever else could be had over or under the table for kicks. It was a wild time. A chance to get drunk, pregnant, beat up, ripped off, and sick, all in the same night. In the middle of town, a community-conscious landowner had opened up a vacant lot and permitted a traveling troupe of enterprising migrants to set up their carnival with rides, booths, and porta-potties. The rides were best viewed in the dark, an escapade in gaily lit rust, powered by unmuffled tractor engines that competed with the wavering carnival music which squawked loudly from somewhere in the middle of it all. But on this warm summer night, the roaming, cotton-candied masses were out to enjoy and joy and joy. A Ferris wheel slowly turned, hesitated for boarding, turned some more for unboarding, then took a few full rotations to give its passengers their money's worth. A merry-go-round spun in a brightly lit, gaudy circle, the peeling and dismembered horses still prancing to the melody of the canned calliope. Carnival-goers threw baseballs at baskets, dimes at ashtrays, darts at balloons, and money to the wind, along the hastily assembled ramshackle midway where the hawkers ranted the same try-your-luck chatter for each passer-by. The two visitors stood tall and silent in the middle of it all, wondering how a town of 12,000 people, including college students, could produce such a vast, teeming crowd. The usually quiet population had turned out in droves, augmented by diversion seekers from elsewhere, until the streets, taverns, stores, alleys, and parking spots were jammed. Anything was allowed, and the illegal was ignored. The police did have their hands full, but each rowdy, vandal, drunk, or hooker in cuffs only meant a dozen more still loose and roaming about the town. The festival, reaching a crescendo now on its last night, was like a terrible storm that couldn't be stopped. One could only wait for it to blow over, and there would be plenty to clean up afterward. The two visitors made their way slowly through the people-packed carnival, listening to the talk, watching the activity. They were inquisitive about this town, so they took their time observing here and there, on the right, on the left, before and behind. The milling throngs were moving around them like swirling garments in a washing machine, meandering from this side of the street to the other in an unpredictable, never-ending cycle. The two tall men kept eyeing the crowd. They were looking for someone. "There," said the dark-haired man. They both saw her. She was young, very pretty, but also very unsettled, looking this way and that, a camera in her hands and a stiff-lipped expression on her face. The two men hurried through the crowd and stood beside her. She didn't notice them. "You know," the dark-haired one said to her, "you might try looking over there." With that simple comment, he guided her by a hand on her shoulder toward one particular booth on the midway. She stepped through the grass and candy wrappers, moving toward the booth where some teenagers were egging each other on and popping balloons with darts. None of that interested her, but then some shadows moving stealthily behind the booth did. She held her camera ready, took a few more silent, careful steps, and then quickly raised the camera to her eye. The flash of the bulb lit up the trees behind the booth as the two men hurried away to their next appointment. They moved smoothly, unfalteringly, passing through the main part of town at a brisk pace. Their final destination was a mile past the center of town, right on Poplar Street, and up to the top of Morgan Hill about a half mile. Practically no time at all had passed before they stood before the little white church on its postage-stamp lot, with its well-groomed lawn and dainty Sunday school and service billboard. Across the top of the little billboard was the name Ashton Community Church, and in black letters hastily painted over whatever name used to be there, it said, Henry L. Bush, Pastor. They looked back. From this lofty hill, one could look over the whole town and see it spread from city limit to city limit. To the west sparkled the caramel-colored carnival. To the east stood the dignified and matronly Whitmore College campus. Along Highway 27, Main Street through town, were the storefront offices, the small-town-sized Sears, a few gas stations at war, a True Value Hardware, the local newspaper, several small family businesses. From here the town looked so typically American, small, innocent, and harmless, like the background for every Norman Rockwell painting. But the two visitors did not perceive with eyes only. Even from this vantage point, the true substratum of Ashton weighed very heavily upon their spirits and minds. They could feel it, restless, strong, growing, very designed and purposeful, a very special kind of evil. It was not unlike either of them to ask questions, to study, to probe. More often than not, it came with their job. So they naturally hesitated in their business, pausing to wonder, why here? But only for an instant. It could have been some acute sensitivity, an instinct, a very faint but for them discernible impression. But it was enough to make them both instantly vanish around the corner of the church, melding themselves against the beveled siding, almost invisible there in the dark. They didn't speak, they didn't move. But they watched with a piercing gaze as something approached. The night scene of the quiet street was a collage of stark blue moonlight and bottomless shadows. But one shadow did not stir with the wind as did the tree shadows, and neither did it stand still as did the building shadows. It crawled, quivered, moved along the street toward the church, while any light it crossed seemed to sink into its blackness as if it were a breach torn in space. But this shadow had a shape, an animated creature-like shape, and as it neared the church, sounds could be heard. The scratching of claws along the ground, the faint rustling of breeze-blown membranous wings wafting just above the creature's shoulders. It had arms and it had legs, but it seemed to move without them, crossing the street and mounting the front steps of the church. Its leering, bulbous eyes reflected the stark blue light of the full moon with their own jaundiced glow. The gnarled head protruded from hunched shoulders, and wisps of rancid red breath seethed in labored hisses through rows of jagged fangs. It either laughed or it coughed. The wheezes puffing out from deep within its throat could have been either. From its crawling posture it reared up on its legs and looked about the quiet neighborhood, the black leathery jowls pulling back into a hideous death mask grin. It moved toward the front door. The black hand passed through the door like a spear through liquid. The body hobbled forward and penetrated the door, but only halfway. Suddenly, as if colliding with a speeding wall, the creature was knocked backward and into a raging tumble down the steps, the glowing red breath tracing a corkscrew trail through the air. With an eerie cry of rage and indignation, it gathered itself up off the sidewalk and stared at the strange door that would not let it pass through. Then the membranes on its back began to billow, enfolding great bodies of air, and it flew with a roar headlong at the door, through the door, and into the foyer, and into a cloud of white-hot light. The creature screamed and covered its eyes, then felt itself being grabbed by a huge, powerful vice of a hand. In an instant it was hurling through space like a rag doll, outside again, forcefully ousted. The wings hummed in a blur as it banked sharply in a flying turn and headed for the door again, red vapors chugging in dashes and streaks from its nostrils, its talons bared and poised for attack, a ghostly siren of a scream rising in its throat. Like an arrow through a target, like a bullet through a board, it streaked through the door and instantly felt its insides tearing loose. There was an explosion of suffocating vapor, one final scream, and the flailing of withering arms and legs. Then there was nothing at all except the ebbing stench of sulfur and the two strangers suddenly inside the church. The big blonde man replaced a shining sword as the white light that surrounded him faded away. "A spirit of harassment?" he asked. "Or doubt. Nor fear. Who knows? And that was one of the smaller ones." "I have not seen one smaller."
"No, indeed. And just how many would you say there are?"
"More. Much more than we. And everywhere. Never idle."
"So I've seen," the big man sighed.
"But what are they doing here? We've never seen such concentration before. Not here."
"Oh, the reason won't be hidden for long."
He looked through the foyer doors and toward the sanctuary.
"Let's see this man of God."
They turned from the door and walked through the small foyer. The bulletin board on the wall carried requests for groceries for a needy family, some babysitting, and prayer for a sick missionary. A large bill announced a congregational business meeting for next Friday. On the other wall, the record of weekly offerings indicated the offerings were down from last week. So was the attendance, from 61 to 42. Down the short and narrow aisle they went, past the orderly ranks of dark-stained plank and slat pews, toward the front of the sanctuary, where one small spotlight illumined a rustic 2x4 cross hanging above the baptistry. In the center of the worn carpeted platform stood the little sacred desk, the pulpit, with a Bible laid open upon it. These were humble furnishings, functional but not at all elaborate, revealing either humility on the part of the people or neglect. Then the first sound was added to the picture. A soft, muffled sobbing from the end of the right pew. There, kneeling in earnest prayer, his head resting on the hard wooden bench and his hands clenched with fervency, was a young man. Very young, the blonde man thought at first. Young and vulnerable. It all showed in his countenance, now the very picture of pain, grief, and love. His lips moved without sound as names, petitions, and praises poured forth with passion and tears. The two couldn't help but just stand there for a moment, watching, studying, pondering. "The little warrior," said the dark-haired one. The big blonde man formed the words himself in silence, looking down at the contrite man in prayer. "Yes," he observed, "this is the one. Even now he's interceding, standing before the Lord for the sake of the people, for the town." "Almost every night he's here." At that remark, the big man smiled.
"He's not so insignificant."
"But he's the only one. He's alone."
"No."
The big man shook his head.
"There are others. There are always others. They just have to be found. For now, his single vigilant prayer is the beginning."
"He's going to be hurt, you know that."
"And so will the newspaper man, and so will we."
"But will we win?" The big man's eyes seemed to burn with a rekindled fire.
"We will fight."
"We will fight," his friend agreed. They stood over the kneeling warrior on either side, and at that moment, little by little, like the bloom of a flower, white light began to fill the room. It illumined the cross on the back wall, slowly brought out the colors and grain in every plank of every pew, and rose in intensity until the once plain and humble sanctuary came alive with an unearthly beauty. The walls glimmered, the worn rugs glowed, the little pulpit stood tall and stark as a sentinel backlit by the sun. And now the two men were brilliantly white, their former clothing transfigured by garments that seemed to burn with intensity. Their faces were bronzed and glowing, their eyes shone like fire, and each man wore a glistening golden belt from which hung a flashing sword. They placed their hands upon the shoulders of the young man, and then, like a gracefully spreading canopy, silken, shimmering, nearly transparent membranes began to unfold from their backs and shoulders, and rise to meet and overlap above their heads, gently undulating in a spiritual wind. Together they ministered peace to their young charge, and his many tears began to subside. The Ashton Clarion was a small-town grassroots newspaper. It was little and quaint, maybe just a touch unorganized at times, unassuming. It was, in other words, the printed expression of the town of Ashton. Its offices occupied a small storefront space on Main Street in the middle of town, just a one-story affair with a large display window and a heavy, toe-scuffed door with a mail slot. The paper came out twice a week on Tuesdays and Fridays, and didn't make a lot of money. By the appearance of the office and layout facilities, you could tell it was a low-budget operation. In the front hall of the building was the office and newsroom area. It consisted of three desks, two typewriters, two wastebaskets, two telephones, one coffee maker without a cord, and what looked like all the scattered notes, papers, stationery, and office bric-a-brac in the world. An old worn counter from a torn-down railroad station formed a divider between the functioning office and the reception area. And, of course, there was a small bell above the door that jingled every time someone came in. Toward the back of this maze of small-scale activity was one luxury that looked just a little too big town for this place, a glassed-in office for the editor. It was, in fact, a new addition. The new editor-owner was a former big-city reporter, and having a glassed-in editor's office had been one of his life's dreams. This new fellow was Marshall Hogan, a strong, big-framed bustler-hustler whom his staff, the typesetter, the secretary-reporter ad-girl, the paste-up man, and the reporter-columnist lovingly referred to as Attila the Hogan. He had bought the paper a few months ago, and the clash between his big-city polish and their small-town easy-go still roused some confrontations from time to time. Marshall wanted a quality paper, one that ran efficiently and smoothly and made its deadlines with a place for everything and everything in its place. But the transition from the New York Times to the Ashton Clarion was like jumping off a speeding train into a wall of half-set jello. Things just didn't click as fast in this little office, and the high-powered efficiency Marshall was used to had to give way to such Ashton Clarion quirks as saving all the coffee grounds for the secretary's compost pile, and someone finally turning in a long-awaited human interest story, but with parakeet droppings on it. On Monday morning, the traffic patterns were hectic, with no time for any weekend hangovers. The Tuesday edition was being brought forth in a rush, and the entire staff was feeling the labor pains, dashing back and forth between their desks in front and the paste-up room in the back, squeezing past each other in the narrow passage, carrying rough copy for articles and ads to be typeset, finished typeset galleys and assorted shapes and sizes of half-tones of photographs that would highlight the news pages. In the back, amid bright lights, cluttered work tables, and rapidly moving bodies, Marshall and Tom the paste-up man bent over a large bench-like easel, assembling Tuesday's Clarion out of bits and pieces that seemed to be scattered everywhere. This goes here. This can't. so we have to shove it somewhere else. This is too big. What do we use to fill this? Marshall was getting miffed. Every Monday and Thursday he got miffed. Edie, he hollered, and his secretary answered, coming. And he told her for the umpteenth time, the galleys go in the trays over the table, not on the table, not on the floor, not on the...
I didn't put any galleys on the floor,
Edie protested as she hurried into the paste-up room with more galleys in her hand. She was a tough little woman of 40 with just the right personality to stand up to Marshall's brusqueness. She still knew where to find things around the office better than anyone, especially her new boss.
I've got them right in your cute little trays where you want them.
So how'd these get here on the floor?
Wind, Marshall, and don't make me tell you where that came from.
All right, Marshall, said Tom. That takes care of pages 3, 4, 6, 7. What about 1 and 2? What are we going to do with all these empty slots?
We're going to put in Bernie's coverage of the festival with clever writing, dramatic human interest photos, the whole bit. As soon as she gets her rear in here and gives them to us, Edie!
Yo!
Bernie's an hour late for crying out loud. Call her again, will you?
Just did. No answer.
Nuts! George, the small retired typesetter who still worked for the fun of it, swiveled his chair away from the typesetting machine and offered, "How about the ladies' auxiliary barbecue? I'm just finishing that up, and the photo of Mrs. Marmazel is spicy enough for a lawsuit." "Eh," Marshall groaned, "right on page 1. That's all I need, a good impression."
"So, what now?" Edie asked.
Anybody make it to the festival? Went fishing, said George. That festival's too wild for me.
My wife wouldn't let me, said Tom. I caught some of it, said Edie.
Start writing, said Marshall. The biggest town buster of the year, and we've got to have something on it. The phone rang.
Saved by the Bell?
Edie chirped as she picked up the backroom extension.
Good morning, the Clarion.
Suddenly she brightened.
"Hey, Bernice, where are you?"
"Where is she?" Marshall demanded at the same time. Edie listened, and her face filled with horror.
"Yes, well, calm down now. Sure, well, don't worry, we'll get you out."
Marshall spouted. "Well, where the heck is she?" Edie gave him a scolding look and answered, "In jail." Chapter 2 Marshall hurried into the basement of the Ashton police station and immediately wished he could disconnect his nose and ears. Beyond the heavily barred gate to the cell block, the crammed jail cells didn't smell or sound much different from the carnival the night before. On his way here, he had noticed how quiet the streets were this morning. No wonder. All the noise had moved inside to these half-dozen peeling painted cells set in cold, echoing concrete. Here were all the dopers, vandals, rowdies, drunks, and no-goods the police could scrape off the face of the town, collected in what amounted to an overcrowded zoo. Some were making a party of it, playing poker for cigarettes with finger-smeared cards and trying to outdo each other's tales of illicit exploits. Toward the end of the cells, a gang of young bucks made obscene comments to a cage full of prostitutes with no better place to be locked up. Others just slumped in corners in a drunken stew or a depressed slump or both. The remainder glared at him from behind the bars, made snide remarks, begged for peanuts. He was glad he had left Kate upstairs. Jimmy Dunlop, the new deputy, was stationed loyally at the guard desk, filling out forms and drinking strong coffee.
"Hey, Mr. Hogan, you got right down here."
"I couldn't wait, and I won't wait," he snapped. He wasn't feeling well. This had been his first festival, and that was bad enough. But he never expected, never dreamed of such a prolonging of the agony. He towered over the desk, his big frame shifting forward to accentuate his impatience.
"Well?" he demanded.
"Hmm?"
"I'm here to get my reporter out of the can."
"Sure, I know that. Have you got a release?"
Listen, I just paid off those yo-yos upstairs. They were supposed to call you down here.
Well, I haven't heard a thing, and I have to have authorization.
Jimmy.
Yeah?
Your phone's off the hook.
Oh.
Marshall set the phone down right in front of him with a firmness that made the phone jingle in pain.
Call him.
Marshall straightened up and watched Jimmy dial wrong, dial again, try to get through. He goes well with the rest of the town, Marshall thought, nervously running his fingers through his graying red hair. Ah, it was a nice town, sure. Cute, maybe a little dumb, kind of like a bumbling kid who always got himself into jams. Things weren't really better in the big city, he tried to remind himself.
Mr. Hogan,
Jimmy asked, his hand over the receiver.
Who was it you talked to?
Kinney.
Sergeant Kinney, please.
Marshall was impatient.
Let's have the key for the gate. I'll let her know I'm here.
Jimmy gave him the key. He'd argued with Marshal Hogan before. A whoop of mock welcome poured out of the cells along with hurled cigarette butts and whistled march tunes as he passed by. He lost no time in finding the cell he wanted.
All right, Kruger. I know you're in there.
Come and get me, Hogan,
came the reply from a desperate and somewhat outraged female voice down near the end.
Well, stick out your arm. Wave at me or something.
A hand stuck out through the bodies and bars and gave him a desperate wave. He got there, gave the palm a slap, and found himself face to face with Bernice Kruger, jailbird, his prize columnist and reporter. She was a young, attractive woman in her mid-twenties, with unkempt brown hair and large, wire-rimmed glasses, now smudged. She had obviously had a hard night and was presently keeping company with at least a dozen women, some older, some shockingly younger, mostly trucked-in prostitutes. Marshall didn't know whether to laugh or spit.
"I won't mince words. You look terrible," he said.
"Only in keeping with my vocation. I'm a hooker now."
"Yeah, yeah, one of us,"
a chunky girl sang out. Marshall grimaced and shook his head. "What kind of questions were you asking out there?"
"Right now, no joke is funny. No anecdote of last night's events is funny. I'm not laughing, I'm seething. The assignment was an insult in the first place."
"Look, somebody had to cover the carnival."
"But we were quite right in our prognostication. There was certainly nothing new under the sun, nor the moon, as it were."
"You got arrested," he offered.
"For the sake of grabbing the reader with a scandalous lead, what else was there to write about?"
"So, read it to me."
A Spanish girl from the back of the cell offered.
"She tried to do business with the wrong trick."
At which the whole cell block guffawed and hooted.
"I demand to be released," Bernice fumed. "And have you stepped in epoxy? Do something."
"Jimmy's on the phone with Kinney. I paid your bail. We'll get you out of here."
Bernice took a moment to simmer down and then reported.
"In answer to your questions, I was carrying on spot interviews trying to get some good pictures, good quotes, good anything. I assume that Nancy and Rosie here," she looked toward two young ladies who could have been twins, and they smiled at Marshall, "wondered what I was doing, constantly circumnavigating the carnival grounds looking bewildered. They struck up a conversation that really got us nowhere news-wise, but did get us all in trouble when Nancy propositioned an undercover cop, and we all got busted together."
"I think she'd be good at it,"
quipped Nancy as Rosie gave her a playful hit. Marshall asked,
"And you didn't show him your ID, your press card?"
"He wouldn't give me a chance. I told him who I was."
"Well, did he hear you?" Marshall asked the girls. "Did he hear her?"
They only shrugged. But Bernice shifted her voice into high gear and cried,
"Is this voice loud enough for you? I employed it last night while he slapped the cuffs on me."
"Welcome to Ashton."
"I'll have his badge."
"It'll only turn your chest green."
Hogan held up his hand to halt another outburst.
"Hey, listen. It isn't worth the trouble.
There are different schools of thought.
Bernie,
I have some things I would love to print. 4 columns wide, all about Super Cop and that do-nothing cretin of a chief. Where is he, anyway?
Who? You mean Brummel?
He has a very handy way of disappearing, you know. He knows who I am. Where is he?
I don't know. I couldn't reach him this morning.
And he turned his back last night.
What are you talking about?
Suddenly she clammed up, but Marshall read her face clear as a bell. Make sure you ask me later. Just then the big gate opened and in came Jimmy Dunlop.
We'll discuss it later, said Marshall. All set, Jimmy?
Jimmy was too intimidated by the yells, demands, hoots, and jeers coming from the cages to answer right away. But he did have the key to the cell in his hand, and that said enough.
Step away from the door, please,
he ordered.
Hey, when's your voice gonna change?
Was characteristic of the answers he got. They did move away from the door. Jimmy opened it. Bernice stepped out quickly, and he slammed it shut again behind her.
Okay, he said. You're free to leave on bail. You'll be notified of the date for your arraignment. Just return my purse, my press card, my notepad, and my camera, Bernice hissed, heading for the door.
Kate Hogan, a slender, dignified redhead, had tried to make good use of her time while waiting upstairs in the courthouse lobby. There was much to observe here after the festival, although it certainly wasn't pleasant. Some woeful souls were escorted and or dragged in, struggling against their cuffs all the way and spouting obscenities. Many others were just now being released after spending the night behind bars. It almost looked like a change of shifts at some bizarre factory, the first shift leaving somewhat sheepishly, their scant belongings still in little paper bags, and the second shift coming in, all bound up and indignant. Most of the police officers were strangers from elsewhere, overtimers sent in to beef up the very small Ashton staff, and they weren't being paid to be kind or courteous. The heavily jowled lady at the main desk had 2 cigarettes smoldering in her ashtray, but little time to take a drag between processing papers on every case coming in or going out. From Kate's viewpoint, the whole operation looked very hurried and slipshod. There were a few cheap lawyers passing out their cards, but one night in jail seemed to be the extent of punishment any of these people would have to bear, and now they only wanted to get out of town in peace. Kate unconsciously shook her head. To think of poor Bernice being herded through this place like so much rabble, she must be furious. She felt a strong but gentle arm around her and let herself sink into its embrace.
She said. Now there's a pleasant change.
After what I had to look at downstairs, I need some healing up, Marshall told her.
She put her arm around him and pulled him close.
Is it like this every year? She asked.
No, I hear it gets worse each time.
Kate shook her head again, and Marshall added.
But the Clarion will have something to say about it. Ashton could use a change of direction. They should be able to see that by now.
How is Bernice?
She'll be one heck of an editorialist for a while. She's okay. She'll live.
Are you going to talk to somebody about this?
Alf Brummel's not around. He's smart. But I'll catch him later today and see what I can do. And I wouldn't mind getting my $25 back.
Well, he must be busy. I'd hate to be the police chief on a day like this.
Oh, he'll hate it even more if I can help it.
Bernice's return from a night of incarceration was marked by an angry countenance and sharp staccato footsteps on the linoleum. She, too, was carrying a paper bag, angrily rummaging through it to make sure everything was there. Kate extended her arms to give Bernice a comforting hug.
Bernice, how are you? Brummel's name will soon be mud, the mayor's name will be dung, and I won't be able to print what that cop's name will be. I'm indignant, I could be constipated, and I desperately need a bath.
Well, said Marshall, take it out on your typewriter, swat some flies. I need that festival story for Tuesday's edition.
Bernice immediately fumbled through her pockets and retrieved a wad of crinkled toilet paper, giving it to Marshall with forcefulness.
Your loyal reporter, always on the job, she said. What else was there to do in there besides watch the paint peel and wait in line for the toilet? I think you'll find the whole write-up very descriptive. And I threw in an on-the-spot interview with some jailed hookers for extra flavor. Who knows? Maybe it'll make this town wonder what it's coming to.
Any pictures? Marshall asked.
Bernice handed him a can of film. You should find something in there you can use. I've got some film still in the camera, but that's of personal interest to me.
Marshall smiled. He was impressed. Take the day off on me. Things will look better tomorrow.
Perhaps by then I will have regained my professional objectivity.
You'll smell better.
Marshall, said Kate. It's okay, said Bernice. He hands me that stuff all the time.
By now she had recovered her purse, press card, and camera and threw the wadded paper bag spitefully into a trash can.
So what's the car situation?
Kate brought your car, Marshall explained. If you could take her home, that should work things out best for me. I've got to get things salvaged at the paper and then try to track down Brummel.
Bernice's thoughts snapped into gear.
Brummel, right. I've got to talk to you.
She started pulling Marshall aside before he could say yay or nay, and he could only give Kate an apologetic glance before he and Bernice rounded a corner and stood out of sight near the restrooms. Bernice spoke in lowered tones.
If you're going to accost Chief Brummel today, I want you to know what I know.
Besides the obvious?
That he's a crumb, a coward, and a cretin? Yes, besides that. It's pieces, disjointed observations, but maybe they'll make sense someday. You always said to have an eye for details. I think I saw your pastor and him together at the carnival last night.
Pastor Young?
Ashton United Christian Church, right? President of the local ministerial. Endorses religious tolerance and condemns cruelty to animals.
Yeah, okay.
But Brummel doesn't even go to your church, does he?
No, he goes to that little dinky one.
They were off behind the dart-throwing booth, in the semi-dark, with three other people. Some blonde woman, some short, pudgy old fellow, and a ghostly-looking black-haired shrew in sunglasses. Sunglasses at night?
Marshall wasn't impressed yet. She continued as if she was trying to sell him something.
I think I committed a cardinal sin against them. I snapped their picture, and from all appearances, they didn't want that. Brummel was quite unnerved and stuttered at me. Young asked me in firm tones to leave. This is a private meeting. The pudgy fellow turned away. The ghostly-looking woman just stared at me with her mouth open.
Have you considered how this might all appear to you after a good bath and a decent night's sleep?
Just let me finish, and then we'll find out, all right. Now, right after that little incident was when Nancy and Rosie latched on to me. I mean to say, I did not approach them. They approached me. And soon afterward, I was arrested and my camera confiscated.
She could see she wasn't getting through to him. He was looking around impatiently, shifting his weight back toward the lobby.
All right, all right. One more thing, she said, trying to hold him in place. Brummel was there, Marshall. He saw the whole thing.
What whole thing?
My arrest. I was trying to explain who I was to the cop. I was trying to show him my press card. He only took my purse and camera away from me and handcuffed me. And I looked over toward the dart-throwing booth again, and I saw Brummel watching. He ducked out of sight right away, but I swear I saw him watching the whole thing. Marshall, I went over this all last night. I replayed it and replayed it, and I think... Well, I don't know what to think, but it has to mean something.
To continue the scenario, Marshall ventured, the film is gone from your camera.
Bernice checked.
Oh, it's still in the camera, but that means nothing.
Hogan sighed and thought the thing over.
Okay, so shoot up the rest of the roll and try to get something we can use, right? Then develop it and we'll see. Can we go now?
Have I ever made any impulsive, imprudent, over-assuming mistakes like this before?
Sure you have.
Oh, come on now. Extend me a little grace just this once.
I'll try to close my eyes.
Your wife's waiting.
I know, I know.
Marshall didn't quite know what to say to Kate when they rejoined her.
Sorry about this, he muttered.
Now then, Kate said, trying to pick up from where they left off. We were talking about vehicles. Bernice, I had to drive your car here so you could have it to get home. If you drop me off at our house...
Yes, right, right, said Bernice.
And Marshall, I have a lot of things to do this afternoon. Can you pick up Sandy after her psychology class?
Marshall didn't say a word, but his face showed a resounding no. Kate took a set of keys from her purse and handed them to Bernice.
Your car is right around the corner next to ours in the press space. Why don't you bring it around?
Bernice took her cue and went out the door. Kate held Marshall with a loving arm and searched his face for a moment.
Hey, come on, try it, just once.
But cockfights are illegal in this state.
If you ask me, she's just a chip off the old block.
I don't know where I'll start, he said.
Just being there to pick her up will mean something. Cash in on it.
As they started for the door, Marshall looked around and let his gut senses feel things out.
Can you figure this town, Kate? He said finally. It's like some kind of disease. Everybody's got the same weird disease around here.
A sunny morning always helps make the previous night's problems seem less severe. That's what Hank Bush thought as he pushed open his front screen door and stepped out onto the small concrete stoop. He lived in a low-rent, one-bedroom house not far from the church, a little white box settled in one corner with beveled siding, small hedged yard, and mossy roof. It wasn't much, and often seemed far less, but it was all he could afford on his pastor's salary. Well, he wasn't complaining. He and Mary were comfortable and sheltered, and the morning was beautiful. This was their day to sleep in, and 2 quarts of milk waited at the base of the steps. He snatched them up, looking forward to a bowl of milk-sodden Wheaties, a bit of distraction from his trials and tribulations. He had known trouble before. His father had been a pastor while Hank was growing up. And the two of them had lived through a great many glories and hassles, the kind that come with pioneering churches, pastoring, itinerating. Hank knew from the time he was young that this was the life he wanted for himself, the way he wanted to serve the Lord. For him, the church had always been a very exciting place to work. Exciting helping his father out in the earlier years, exciting going through Bible school and seminary, and then 2 years of pastoral internship. It was exciting now, too, but it resembled the exhilaration the Texans must have felt at the Alamo. Hank was just 26 and usually full of fire. But this pastorate, his very first, seemed a difficult place to get the fire spread around. Somebody had wetted down all the kindling, and he didn't know what to make of it yet. For some reason, he had been voted in as pastor, which meant somebody in the church wanted his kind of ministry. But then there were all the others, the ones who made it exciting. They made it exciting whenever he preached on repentance. They made it exciting whenever he confronted sin in the fellowship. They made it exciting whenever he brought up the cross of Christ and the message of salvation. At this point, it was more Hank's faith and assurance that he was where God wanted him than any other factor that kept him by his guns, standing steadfast while getting shot at. Oh, well, Hank thought to himself, at least enjoy the morning. The Lord put it here just for you.
Had he backed into the house again without turning, he would have spared himself an outrage and kept his lightened spirit. But he did turn to go back in and immediately confronted the huge black dripping letters spray-painted on the front of the house. "You're dead meat, you." The last word was an obscenity. His eyes saw it, then did a slow pan from one side of the house to the other, taking it all in. It was one of those things that take time to register. All he could do was stand there for a moment, first wondering who could have done it, then wondering why, then wondering if it would ever come off. He looked closer and touched it with his finger. It had to have been done during the night. It was quite dry.
"Honey," came Mary's voice from inside, "you're leaving the door open."
"Hmm," was all he said, having no better words. He didn't really want her to know. He went back inside, closing the door firmly, and joined young, beautiful, long-tressed Mary over a bowl of Wheaties and some hot buttered toast. Here was the sunny spot in a cloudy sky for Hank, this playful little wife with the melodic giggle. She was a doll, and she had real grit, too. Hank often regretted that she had to go through the struggles they were now having. After all, she could have married some stable, boring accountant or insurance salesman. But she was a terrific support for him, always there, always believing God for the best, and always believing in Hank, too.
"What's wrong?" she asked immediately.
"Rats. You do what you can to hide it, you try to act normal, but she still picks it up," Hank thought. He started to say.
"Still bothered about the board meeting?"
"There's your out, Bush."
"Sure, a little. I didn't even hear you come home. Did the meeting last real late?"
"No, Alf Rimmel had to take off for some important meeting he wouldn't talk about, and the others just, you know, had their say and went home. Just left me to lick my wounds. I stuck around and prayed for a while. I think that worked. I felt okay after that." He brightened just a little. "As a matter of fact, I really felt the Lord comforting me last night."
"I still think they picked a funny time to call a board meeting right during the festival," she said.
"And on Sunday night," he said through his flakes, "I no sooner give the altar call than I get them calling a meeting."
"About the same thing?"
"Oh, I think they're just using Lou as an excuse to make trouble."
"Well, what did you tell them?"
"The same thing all over again. We did just what the Bible says. I went to Lou, then John, then I went to Lou, then we brought it before the rest of the church, and then we removed him from fellowship."
"Well, it did seem to be what the congregation decided. But why can't the board go along with it?"
"They can't read. Don't the Ten Commandments have something in there about adultery?"
"I know, I know."
Hank set down his spoon so he could gesture better.
"And they were mad at me last night. They started giving me all this stuff about judging not, lest I be judged." "Who did?"
"Oh, the same old Alf Rimmel camp. Alf, Sam Turner, Gordon Mayer, you know, the old guard."
"Well, don't just let them push you around."
"They won't change my mind anyway. Don't know what kind of job security that gives me." Now Mary was getting indignant.
"Well, what on earth is wrong with Alf Rimmel? Has he got something against the Bible or the truth or what? If it weren't this, it would certainly be something else."
"Jesus loves him, Mary," Hank cautioned.
"It's just that he feels under heavy conviction. He's guilty, he's a sinner, he knows it. And guys like us will always bother guys like him. The last pastor preached the word, and Alf didn't like it. Now I'm preaching the word, and he still doesn't like it. He pulls a lot of weight in that church, so I guess he thinks he can dictate what comes across that pulpit."
"Well, he can't."
"Not in my case, anyway." "So why doesn't he just go somewhere else?"
Hank pointed his finger dramatically. "That, dear wife, is a good question. There seems to be a method in his madness, like it's his mission in life to destroy pastors."
"It's just the picture they keep painting of you. You're just not like that." Yes, painting. Are you ready?
Ready for what?
Hank drew a breath, sighed it out, then looked at her.
We had some visitors last night.
They painted a slogan on the front of the house.
What? Our house?
Well, our landlord's house. She got up.
Where?
She went out the front door, her fuzzy slippers scuffing on the front walk.
Oh, no!
Hank joined her, and they drank in the view together. It was still there, real as ever.
Now that makes me mad, she declared.
But now she was crying.
What did we ever do to anybody?
I think we were just talking about it, Hank suggested. Mary didn't catch what he said, but she had a theory of her own, the most obvious one.
Maybe the festival. It always brings out the worst in everyone.
Hank had his own theory, but said nothing. It had to be someone in the church, he thought. He'd been called a lot of things, a bigot, a heel-dragger, an overly moral troublemaker. He had even been accused of being a homosexual and of beating his wife. Some angry church member could have done this, perhaps a friend of Lou Stanley, the adulterer, perhaps Lou himself. He would probably never know. But that was all right. God knew.
Chapter 3 Just a few miles east of town, on Highway 27, a large black limousine raced through the countryside. In the plush back seat, a plump middle-aged man talked business with his secretary, a tall and slender woman with long jet-black hair and a pale complexion. He talked crisply and succinctly as she took fluid shorthand, laying out some big-scale business deal. Then something occurred to the man.
That reminds me, he said, and the secretary looked up from her memo pad. The professor claims she sent me a package some time ago, but I don't recall ever receiving it.
What kind of package?
A small book, a personal item. Why not make a note to yourself to check for it back at the ranch?
The secretary opened her portfolio and appeared to make a note of it. Actually, she wrote nothing. It was Marshall's second visit to Courthouse Square in the same day. The first time was to get Bernice bailed out, and now it was to pay a visit to the very man Bernice wanted to string up, Alf Brimmel, the chief of police. After the Clarion finally got to press, Marshall was about to call Brimmel, but Sarah, Brimmel's secretary, called Marshall first and made an appointment for 2 o'clock that afternoon. That was a good move, Marshall thought. Brimmel was calling for a truce before the tanks began to roll. He pulled his Buick into his reserved parking space in front of the new courthouse complex and paused beside his car to look up and down the street, surveying the aftermath of the festival's final Sunday night death throes. Main Street was trying to be the same old Main Street again, but to Marshall's discerning eye, the whole town seemed to be walking with a limp, sort of tired, sore, and sluggish. The usual little gaggles of half-hurried pedestrians were doing a lot of pausing, looking, head-shaking, regretting. For generations, Ashton had taken pride in its grassroots warmth and dignity and had striven to be a good place for its children to grow up. But now there were inner turmoils, anxieties, fears, as if some kind of cancer was eating away at the town and invisibly destroying it. On the exterior, there were the store windows now replaced with unsightly plywood, the many parking meters broken off, the litter and broken glass up and down the street. But even as the store owners and businessmen swept up the debris, there seemed to be an unspoken sureness that the inner problems would remain, the troubles would continue. Crime was up, especially among the youth. Simple, common trust in one's neighbor was diminishing. Never had the town been so full of rumors, scandals, and malicious gossip. In the shadow of fear and suspicion, life here was gradually losing its joy and simplicity, and no one seemed to know why or how. Marshall headed into Courthouse Square. The square consisted of two buildings, tastefully garnished with willows and shrubs, facing a common parking lot. On one side was the classy two-story brick courthouse, which also housed the town's police department and that somewhat decadent basement cell block. One of the town's three squad cars was parked outside. On the other side was the two-story glass-fronted town hall, housing the mayor's office, the town council, and other decision-makers. Marshall headed for the courthouse. He went through the unimposing plain doorway marked police, and found the small reception area empty. He could hear voices from down the hall and behind some of the closed doors, but Sarah, the secretary, seemed temporarily out of the room. No. Behind the receptionist for Micah top counter, a huge file was slowly rocking back and forth, and grunts and groans were coming up from below. Marcia leaned over the counter to see a comical sight. Sarah, on her knees, dress or no dress, was in the middle of a blue-streaked struggle with a jammed file drawer that had entangled itself with her desk. Apparently, the score was file drawers 3, Sarah's shin 0, and Sarah was a poor loser. So were her pantyhose. She let out an ill-timed curse just as her eye caught him standing there, and by then it was too late to rebuild her usual poised image.
Oh, hi, Marshall.
Wear your marine boots next time. They're better for kicking things in. At least they knew each other, and Sarah was glad for that. Marshall had been in this place often enough to become well acquainted with most of the staff.
These, she said with the tone of an articulate tour guide, are the infamous file cabinets of Mr. Alf Brummel, chief of police. He just got some fancy new cabinets, so now I've inherited these. Why I have to have them in my office is beyond me, but upon his express orders, here they must stay.
They're too ugly to go into his office.
But khaki? It's him, you know. Oh, well, maybe a little decoupage would cheer them up. If they must move in here, the least they can do is smile.
Just then the intercom buzzed. She pressed the button and answered.
Yes, sir?
Brummel's voice squawked out of the little box.
Hey, my security alarm is flashing.
Sorry, that was me. I was trying to get one of your file drawers shut.
Yeah, right. Well, try to rearrange things, will you?
Marshall Hogan is here to see you.
Oh, right. Send him in.
She looked up at Marshall and only shook her head pathetically.
Got an opening for a secretary? She muttered.
Marshall smiled.
She explained, he's got these files right next to the silent alarm button. Every time I open a drawer, the building's surrounded.
With a goodbye wave, Marshall went to the nearest office door and let himself into Brummel's office. Alf Brummel stood and extended his hand, his face exploding in a wide, ivory smile.
Hey, there's the man!
Hey, Alf. They shook hands as Brummel ushered Marshall in and closed the door. Brummel was a man somewhere in his 30s, single, a one-time hotshot city cop with a big-buck lifestyle that belied his policeman's salary. He always came on like a likable guy, but Marshall never really trusted him. Come to think of it, he didn't like him that much, either. Too much teeth showing for no reason.
Well, Brummel grinned. Have a seat, have a seat.
He was talking again before either man's cushion could compress.
Looks like we made a laughable mistake this weekend.
Marshall recalled the sight of his reporter sharing a cell with prostitutes.
Bernice didn't laugh the whole night, and I'm out $25.
Well, said Brummel, reaching into his top desk drawer, that's why we're having this meeting, to clear this whole thing up. Here.
He produced a check and handed it to Marshall.
This is your refund on that bail money, and I want you to know that Bernice will be receiving an official signed apology from myself in this office.
But Marshall, please tell me what happened. If I'd just been there, I could have put a stop to it.
Bernie says you were there.
I was? Where?
I know I was in and out of the station all night, but
no, she saw you there at the carnival. Brummel forced a wider grin.
Well, I don't know who it was she saw, in actuality, but I wasn't at the carnival last night. I was busy here.
Marshall had too much momentum.